All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
This episode is brought to you by Raycon and Vincero. More on that later. Let's get into the do.
You're listening to The Honeydew with Ryan Sickler.
Welcome back to The Honeydew, y'all. We're over here at Studio Jeans doing it at your mom's house. I'm Ryan Sickler. You can find me on all social media at Ryan Sickler. My website is ryansickler.com. Minneapolis, you're going to see me soon. August 1st through 3rd, I'll be out there. Baltimore, back again in September at the Famous. All tickets are on sale at my website, ryansickler.com. You can go there and check that out. And the Honeydew info, let's get you that info right now. The website is thehoneydewpodcast.com. That's where you can go get everything you want to know. You can follow it all on social media there. Merch is there. Everything you need to know is there. And as always, I like to say thank you to you guys every week. I'm blown away by the response. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And for those of you that are new to the show, what we do here every week is we highlight the lowlights. These are the stories behind the storytellers, and it is my pleasure to bring this storyteller, ladies and gentlemen. 4 DUIs, 3 passports. Oh, I fucked it up. Hold on. 4 legs, 3 DUIs, 2 passports. Channel 1 News, y'all. Josh Adam Myers.
Honeydew, you. It's the same old honeydew. You don't have like a theme for that. You don't like that.
Does anybody have a fucking theme?
No, but I thought, I don't know. I just felt like giving
Valerie
you a little.
Valerie by Steve Winwood over there.
Honeydew. Break free of honeydew.
We got to cut all this out.
No, don't cut this out.
This is what he does on his podcast. I'll tell you about it. He puts in 12 minutes of albums. And then you're like, I got to cut that out.
Wait. You mean I can't play all that Burt Bacharach record?
Well, it is a pleasure to have you back here.
So happy to be here, buddy.
I'm so happy for you. You got a lot going on. You can tell people everything you want them to know about Josh Adam Myers. Have at it.
I have a podcast that I love doing. It's called The 500 with Josh Adam Myers. I am going through Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums, starting at 500. Working our way down to 1, and I'm sitting down with huge comics. I've had Bill Burr, I've had Wanda Sykes, and I've had you on doing B.B. King, and everybody knows how much you love B.B. King.
It was so much fun.
Get your dick out of that man's ass! All right, here comes Little Red Rooster. But it's basically an audiobook club using the greatest recorded music in the history of mankind, and we use the album that we're breaking down as a roadmap to interview the guest. And it's on all platforms. It's on all platforms.
Get your podcast and your platforms.
Yeah, but you can listen to it on any platform. And it's going to be going until May 31st, 2028 is when we're doing the final episode.
Great. What's your social media?
At Josh Adam Myers on all social media, and my website, joshadammyers.com. Also for the podcast, you can find it at 500podcast.com.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the show. Congratulations on all your success.
Thank you, buddy. I love it.
You know, if you haven't heard Josh's Craft Feast episodes, you have to go back and listen to his Craft Feast episodes. I just always describe Josh as that lovable degenerate cousin, and that's exactly
we are family. You can't get rid of me. I've already been on the Honeydew more than anybody.
Yeah, I know.
This is 5.
I'm the
herpes of comedy. Like you can't get rid of me. You try to, but you can't.
So if you know, you've heard anything about Josh, you'll know Josh is definitely a honeydew.
I'm 100% a honeydew.
But one thing you and I were talking about, when I tell you always to come with great stories as you do, but really what's behind all that? Again, we say the story's behind the storyteller. So why don't you get into, and we'll get into specifics,
sure.
But what really started your honeydew?
Me being planted, is what you're saying?
What started it for you? Where's the genesis of all this craziness that we've heard about over the years?
Well, all right, so I was born in Germantown, Maryland, which is about 20 miles outside of Washington, D.C., and I had just a normal, like, family, like, normal nuclear family. Like, I had, you know, my dad, my mom, a sister, and me. And when I was born, my dad was pretty, I wouldn't say successful, but I mean, he was making well over $100,000 a year being an accountant.
What did he do, accountant?
He was an accountant for ADP. And I remember it being like,
yeah, you know me.
You know what, ADP? Yeah, you know me.
You know that they did some local commercial in DC, like Channel 5 back then.
If you down with that AP thing, I forgot the fucking thing. You know what AP does. So my dad worked for ADP. Thank you. And it was just a normal family. And I remember, like, shortly after I was born, maybe when I was around 4, my dad lost his job. Well, he didn't lose his job. He actually, they were like downsizing. And so they were letting
they
go.
They lost him.
They lost nobody.
It's not really like you're losing your job.
No.
More like we're losing you.
No, but my dad was a honeydew. Like 100% a honeydew, because this guy could have gone to law school and went to law school, almost finished it, and then dropped out, right?
Do you
and
know
then,
why? Was a kid.
I think my dad had a lot of, like, he didn't have a dad. That's the other thing that I think, you know, really comes into play, is that my dad lost his father when he was 7 years old.
Okay.
So this is, you know, 1947. My bubby, his mother, literally didn't work, didn't do anything. And so she, when my grandfather died, my bubby just started taking it out on the kids. Do you know what I mean? She didn't hit them, but she verbally abused them. Whereas my dad kind of, you know, he had a normal life for the most part, but like my dad's sister, like, she might have had autism, she might have been on the spectrum, and basically for the rest of her life, she just lived with my grandmother. And now she has, like, you know, 9 cats living in Harrisburg in like a small apartment, like, and I never talked to her post him dying. So I don't think my dad had a father. So when my dad was working for ADP and they were letting go of all these different people at the company, my dad, they weren't going to fire my dad, but my dad quit because he was mad that they fired all of his friends. And my dad went from ADP, which is like a normal job, like working and like making money, steady paycheck. And my dad went into sales, and my dad was horrible at sales. So that caused a lot of like uncertainty in the household between.
But horrible because you could feel the difference in the income and everything. Living. But
yeah. Well,
how
I'm
do you know
I'm too young sales? To understand like missing out on stuff. Like, I remember I would ask for stuff and, you know, and my mom would buy it for me. My dad wouldn't. Because my dad was more of like a stickler with money. And like my mom was just like, we'll put it on a credit cards and just doing whatever the fuck like she could do to make me and my sister happy. But what I started noticing around 4 and 5 was just like the beginning of the fighting in the house between my mom and dad. And so my sister.
Who's older? Your sister's older?
My sister's older than me. She's older by like 2 years. And my sister was always this like, she's a doctor now with 3 kids, married to a lawyer, and is very selfless and like went to Israel to teach kids how to speak English and just is such a good kid and never got in trouble. And I started acting up like right around 4 or 5 is when I remember starting to get into trouble. And it was like
and that coincided at the same with your parents arguing
with my parents arguing. Yeah. And I think
now you're not getting attention. They're all, it's negative attention, but it's going back and forth between them.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, it's like, I always remember like them fighting and my mom crying a lot. And my sister would just be upstairs studying. And that was kind of, I think, right around the time, like 5, 6, 7 is when I started really finding out about music. And so I just wanted to fit in with my dad, and my dad was really into music. So I just was like,
what would he listen to?
He listened to a lot of jazz. He liked some rock, but not nearly as much as I did. And so I remember like getting into Iron Maiden at the time and Guns N' Roses. And then it's like around 7, 8 is when I started really acting up. And that was when I started like stealing from my dad. I started stealing money out of his wallet so I could buy different records, because like I didn't really have any friends my own age. So I started hanging out with these older kids. Robert Drolinger, his dad was never there. We'd always go over to his house and like we just like, we have these like ice fights in his house with like ice cubes. We get like a TV tray and start like chucking ice
just
at each other.
In the house.
Just throwing them in the house. Dude, I think hanging out with those kids.
That's like throwing rocks inside.
Oh, Domino's Pizza's here. All right, hold up. But like we would just, that was hanging out with like Brad Bliven and Robert Drolinger, who were kind of like not the bad kids, but like Robert just like he was like a shit, he was like the B-Crafts, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like a shit family. And and luckily I didn't meet the B-Crafts because I wouldn't be here today, but I remember hanging out with them. I wanted them to think that I was cool, so that's why I started stealing money from my parents. And it was like,
and they gave you that idea?
They didn't give it to me, but
once I did that,
like, and I bought everybody pizza, and then I took us to go see Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Oh, you were the hero.
Dude, I was the fucking man. He's like, you want that rat cassette? You want rat?
Out to sell it. You want out to sell it?
What you want? But I was buying pizza for us, and that was where, so I'm 7 or 8, and that is when, my dad never had really hit me or done anything. He'd spank me, but when they found out that I stole money, I remember.
How did they find out?
Well, so I remember I went and took money out of their drawer. They had a drawer with like an envelope in it. And I like ran out of the house and they're waiting there. I'm like, I got money. Like, let's go. Waxy Maxies. And we go head up there.
Yeah.
And I get, and I remember coming home and I was like walking into the house, and I walk up to go into my room, and my dad just started running at me and just like cornered me. Like on the bed, he didn't hit me, but it was just like screaming at me, like, you motherfucker, you fucking
really?
Shit, you steal from me, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like shaking me, and I'm all like, my mom's like, Albert, stop, you're gonna kill him. And then from that moment on, like my dad just started, he just was different with me. Do you know what I mean? And it became more of like him putting me down, you know? And it's not like, and I didn't do bad in school, but I didn't do great. You know, I did well enough to pass. And so my dad, you know, would just put me down, and my mom would be the one that would stick up for me. And my sister would, you know, just be doing great. And we had a tight relationship, but my dad would never say anything bad about Jody. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I guess that just started wearing on me. And then I started really acting out. Like I just,
how old are you now?
Now
no.
Or at this point of the yeah. Like at this point of the story, I mean, we can move it up to about 13, because at 13
that's when you really stepped
well,
it up.
I got in trouble many, because I kept stealing from them. Like I remember I stole money to buy the Deion Sanders Nikes.
That's a lot of money.
I mean, that's $140. Yeah. I took a check and went to Foot Locker. I remember. Oh, you mean this 11-year-old, he's buying everybody's shoes? Like I just didn't think about the consequences. I would just act up. And I had friends that were, you know, like, not degenerates at all. Like, I would never call my friends degenerates, but
I'll do it. They were degenerates.
Well, you're one of my friends.
Well,
you got a little degenerate.
Talking about back then, I definitely have a little degenerate.
You got 100% degenerate. But
honey dude and degenerate.
Yeah, we're all dudes. Podcast. Everybody's honeydew. So I remember I was hanging out with my friend Greg and I had friends like Paul. And this is before I started really like smoking cigarettes and doing drugs, but we started like stealing from my parents' liquor cabinet. And I would really act up in class. Like I'd get ISS a lot, and I would in school suspension.
Oh.
Like I would get in trouble a lot, but I was funny when I did stuff, so everybody liked me. But then I remember when I was like 13, I had to go to the Jewish Community Center once a week to go to therapy with other kids that were like bad, you know? And I remember going.
And is it one-on-one or is it group
therapy? Oh, it's group. It's group, dude.
At the JCC?
Just at the JCC. And I, like, it was, like, I'm in there, like, I'm not as bad as these kids. Like, these kids were, like, smoking weed already and fucking and, like, doing all this stuff. And, like, super, like, you know, confrontational with the lady, like, the psychiatrist or whatever she was, therapist. And that was when I really knew that I, like, I guess I was, like, not just headed down a bad path, but I was like, I'm still not as bad as these kids, but I, you know, is there something wrong with me? And then my dad's shitting on me. So I just have this horrible view of myself, you know? And then it was probably around 13, 14 when I started smoking pot and when I was in high school. And that was when I found like Tassos, Ben, all the guys like that were in the smoking section. They all were like grunge listening to music kids and were in a band. And that was when I started finding drugs. So.
And what happened?
Oh, you want to keep going? Okay. So
no, we can end it there.
No, I thought you were going to ask, you just thought you were going to ask a question. So
well, that's when you started drugs.
So yeah, that's kind of when I started drugs.
Story to,
that just leads us up to why I started finding drugs. So then when I found
weed
drugs,
was your first?
Weed was the first. So it was me, Mark Thomas, Tassos, and some rando girl sitting by a creek, just packing like the swaggiest of the brown terrible. Weed.
Practice
and you hear like seeds like. Yeah, like popping in it.
My brother said, "Don't smoke that. Got cyanide in them." That's what he used to say all the time.
I mean, it's just if I haven't seen swag in years, and it would blow my mind if somebody pulled out swag nowadays. But I remember smoking with them for the first time, and we go to walk back up the hill to go to this Wendy's, and Mark Thomas just started getting like super pale white. And then just started throwing up right in front of me. And this is the first time. We just smoked like six bowls. And my heart's like fucking this. And I don't think I've ever. I think it was like, I'm about to have a heart attack. This is it. I'm going to die right here by the creek. And eventually, of course, it wore off. And I was like, all right, well, now I have pot. And then I started experimenting with like LSD and really started drinking and. I had never really learned how to drink proper because when we first started, we all just started doing the, what do you call it? Like the beer bongs.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you do. I shouldn't say that's what everybody does, but so many people, you drink until you get sick or pass out or you beer bong as many as you can that quick.
I remember the first party I went to, in high school. I mean, like, it's like right at the end of ninth grade. And it's at Chaitna Sinha's house, and it's all like the seniors and like all the beautiful kids, and then like me, Tassos, and Ben, and all of us like walking in, and we were really into Ice House at the time. You remember Ice House beer?
Oh yeah, of course.
It was like 11% alcohol, yep, so that was absolutely. Why we bought it. And I remember like I had beer bonged a few beers before. You'd get drunk and you'd wander around, maybe pass out in a bush, like laying on the like just giggling, and it was great. But I saw the beer bong and I wanted people to think I was cool. So I was like, load me up a beer bong. And I hit that one. Well, I did 11 straight beers.
What?
11 straight. Like literally.
That's people, a lot people of
like,
fucking.
He's still going. And I was just like, it was just like my shining moment. I'm like, yeah.
I'll show you, Dad. I'll show you, Dad.
And so. Right at the last one, I think I go for number 12, and that one gets into me, and then I just start vomiting everywhere in front of all the seniors that were, like, cheering me on. I mean, just projectile vomit. Like, it was so bad. And then everybody's
like a Gallagher concert. And then, yeah, people covered up.
Like, God, you just see Guar? Nah, Josh threw up. So I go, they put me downstairs in her basement, and then they put like a piece of carpet on me. I guess that it, you know, that was like spare.
That was a blanket.
That was my blanket, was a piece of carpet, and I took my shoes off right next to me. And then I remember just suddenly being woken up by this kid that we used to call him Ham Sandwich, because he used to rollerblade like through our neighborhood, and me and my buddy Greg would like make fun of him because he was rollerblading. We'd be like, "What's up, Ham Sandwich?" And then, and then he'd roll by and he was like, "I'm gonna fucking kill you guys."
I would love to hear somebody on rollerblade say that.
He had on like the
the wrist guard,
like the helmet, and all the pads. But then, like, I remember he, throughout the history from the start of that until I turned like 13, 14, like, I would run into him and he would like chase after me. And this guy was fucking crazy.
Dude,
he'd be like, "Hold up for a second."
Yeah.
But he was quick and he would catch up to me and corner me and I'd have to like run home. Well, it just so happens he was at that party. And so when I'm passed out,
Ham
Sandwich was there. When I was passed out drunk, like laying with the carpet on me, he just wakes up and starts like hitting me.
He's beating you awake.
Like, he's like, "You motherfucker." I remember being like, "Ah." And he's just like hitting me and like kicking me on the ground. And then he just takes my shoes and leaves. And so I wake up that night and I had no shoes and I had to walk like 3 miles back to my parents' house. When you get there, and then like my dad sees me with no shoes from my Airwalks that he had just bought me, and
he bought them, he supplied the money that you stole.
He bought the shoes, but like to see like the trying to make up a story about how I lost them, and he was just like, you could just see the look in his eyes of just being like, "All right, well, you were out drinking, and now he's starting to know that I'm doing alcohol and smoking pot," and so he just keeps continuously like, you know, just shitting on me. And yeah, so from that, when I started drinking, I never had learned how to drink proper. And then, you know, skip ahead, I graduate high school and right around 19,
you said you weren't a bad student. What was your GPA?
No, my GPA was probably like 2.5. You know, I was a C student. I did enough to pass, but I was well liked in high school. Like it was weird because, like, you know, I think knowing that my family was doing really bad, because in high school was when we had like no money, and I'm coming home every day and my mom's crying, and so I could avoid that. I would just go outside and listen to the soundtrack to Philadelphia.
Oh my God, that uplifting soundtrack.
Someone think that I someone, and I'm just outside like crying. Because my parents and the home life was so bad. So I just started using my like humor as like a defense mechanism for me in high school, which made me very popular by making fun of other kids, you know, or just being like saying something really loud in class that was inappropriate. And then I'd go and get in trouble. And right around the end of high school, we had my great uncle died. And my great uncle left me, my sister, and a bunch of kids our age.
Is this your dad's or mom's brother?
This is on my dad's side.
Okay.
My Uncle Benny, who looked like Robert De Niro from Goodfellas. Like, he was just this really, really, like, cool guy in the 50s and 60s. And then he started going senile, probably in the 80s. Not 80s, probably like 90s. and so he just started, like, hoarding his money. So he would go to like the Jewish community center and steal food just so he didn't have to pay for food. And so when he died, like, he had a lot of money. So he left me and my sister and a bunch of kids our age, like 40 grand.
Wow.
And each. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, I remember like just the dichotomy between the day before the money and the day after, because the day before coming home, like, I'm high and, you know, my mom and dad are screaming at each other. You know, Jody by that point was already away at college. And so it was just me in there just taking the brunt of everything, like, you know, because my dad would yell at me for bad grades, would yell at me for this, yell at me for that. And so then that day when I came home with that money, just how happy the house was, because we almost lost our house. My dad's friend had to buy it from us and then rent it back to us.
That's a good friend.
George Whitehouse. Yeah, that was it sucked.
George Whitehouse bought your old house.
George Whitehouse bought the old house.
Oh, the name Whitehouse.
But George Whitehouse, like, I remember how happy my mom was the day that George threw that offer out that I would buy the house and then rent it back to you. And then, like, and just for, like, those 2 weeks, it was just this beautiful, like, there was, like, hope. because it had been so bad and the money was so tight. And then I remember 2 weeks after he said he could do it, he was like, I don't think I can. And then to have that hit us. And so skip ahead to maybe, I don't even know how long, like 6 months after that, when they were about to foreclose on our house, I got the money. Me and my sister both gave my parents 20 grand to pay off all their debt, or at least get back to a number that they can afford, and to get the house back.
Right.
And so what I do is just like, I had never had money before. So I just started spending that money as fast as possible. And I went out and bought like, you know, fucking $2,000 worth of fleeces.
So they
were popular at the time.
So many fleeces.
That's so much. I probably had like,
that's
like
how you got the king like, of fleece nickname.
That's why I'm king of fleece. I had like 12 fleeces assorted: Nautica, Tommy Hilfiger, Polo, Ralph Lauren, Polo. Timberland. I had some Polo at Timberland, but I just never had money, and I started taking people out to eat, and I started like, you know, by that point I had started, you know, dating, because I hadn't dated for, like, it was weird. Like, I think when I first got into high school, like, I was so hyperactive ADD that girls, when they first meet me, be like, oh, he's cute, you know, and then a friend would be like, pass him a note. And then, you know, a week later after they got to know me, they were just like, you know, I don't like you anymore. Like, you're completely batshit insane. And I'm like high as fuck on Adderall, because it just gave me more speed. My ADD, I'd been medicated since I was like, I don't know, 5 years old. And so they had, you know, just been giving me a pill in the morning and a pill at lunch, and it would just wire me. And so that's what also made me so funny, because I was just running around and had incredible amounts of like, of energy. But my senior year, I had this like really bad view of myself, and hadn't been dating. It was only in the summers what I would date, but it would have been, My senior year in October, I had jaw surgery. So I had TMJ. And so they cut my whole jaw out and put like, cut a bone out of here and a bone out of here and put four screws and then two steel plates. And so that was right around homecoming, and I couldn't go to homecoming. And then when I got back to school, my face was so swollen. And at first people were like, you know, like, oh, you're starting to look better, the swelling's going down. And then one day that just stopped. And so I just thought, like, I must be this hideous freak now. So my personal view of myself was just, I had my dad shitting on me. I have this traumatic thing happen to my face. And I just thought everybody thought I was, like, ugly. And, like, and then I'm, like, I'm not getting any girls. And so I have this horrible view of who I am. And that was when I started really starting to drink more and starting to party, because at that point is when I felt cool. And I inherit that money, and then I decide to go to Europe. And when I get to Europe, it's me and my buddy Joel, and we spent like 5 months in Europe backpacking.
Damn.
Yeah, and like we're there, and it was like on a $20 a day budget, but it's just drinking every night. And then we end the trip in Amsterdam. And when I get to Amsterdam, that was when I found ecstasy. Now, I had done like weed and LSD,
and
maybe mushrooms and Adderall, but I never looked at Adderall as like a drug. Like, I just looked at it as medication the doctor gave me. But then I did ecstasy there. And so when I came back to the States, like, we had gone to my first rave in Amsterdam. When I came back to the States, I got this job immediately at Mozzarella's, the American Cafe, just with a shitload of degenerates, dude. Everybody that worked there, Ryan, was a fucking honeydew. Like, they got like, just like, hey man, table 6 needs a nice seat, but they're having to go fuck themselves. I ain't getting them. I mean, it was just the trashiest people, but also a bunch of kids my age. And this kid, Todd Cavanaugh, was like, hey man, it's like, you know, I go to this rave every Friday night at Buzz, and he's like, would you want to come? And so that then became my introduction into like the rave scene in DC.
The DC drug rave scene?
Well, that's basically what it was. It was just that
ecstasy big during that time of the raves, or what are the drugs?
Yeah, there was ecstasy. Well, originally that's what brought me to the raves, which was like, oh, I had done ecstasy in Amsterdam. Like, I want to do it again. And I didn't give a shit about the music. But you go to this whole world where it's like, you know, you're going in and there's people, like really good looking people all dancing, having a good time and like, you know, putting their arms around one another, being like, I love you, man. It's like, you just met me. And I had never seen anything like that. My friends growing up never, like, I remember when my dad died and Jason Moyer came up to me and I'm like going to hug him and he just goes, hey, go, man, pats me on the back. I'm like, God damn. Like, there you go, brother. Now, because if I touch you, everybody's going to think I'm gay. And I don't, that's the last thing is like they, I just had the I'm most. Sure,
I know your dad's gone, but I
stay over there. It's like, I'm
my reputation doesn't need
giving
to be
you love. I'm giving you love. But so I had never had people or friends that would go out and do like and show affection like that. And you go into this rave scene and that was the first time I felt like I had like a family with these degenerates that I'm just meeting. You know, you've never done ecstasy, right?
Ecstasy, I have.
You have?
A couple times.
So then you know that it's this incredible feeling and that, and it's also just a pill, so you don't think it's that bad.
Yeah, I did it twice and I was like, eh.
So I started doing it probably twice a week.
Let's take a quick break from the show to tell you about our first sponsor, Raycon. It's 2019. Everyone needs a great pair of wireless earbuds. But before you go dropping hundreds of dollars on a pair, you need to check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. I just took mine traveling. I wanted to put them to the test. Took them on the plane, walked around, made calls. They are awesome. I could hear everything through the plane noise. I took them. I was in Minneapolis at the Mall of America, and I could hear everything, took calls, made calls, not one problem with them at all. They're unbelievable. They started about half the price of any other premium wireless earbuds on the market, and they sound just as amazing. The company was actually co-founded by Ray J, and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, Cardi B, Melissa Etheridge are already obsessed. Raycon's E50 wireless earbuds have totally changed the game for me. They're so comfortable and so easy to take anywhere. They also have little earpieces, so if you have different size, you can tailor it to your ear hole. Unlike some of your other wireless options, Raycon earbuds are both stylish and discreet with no dangling wires or stems, and of course, they don't just look great, they sound great too. Raycon offers their wireless earbuds for everyone in a range of fun colors and at an unbeatable price. Go to buyraycon.com/honeydew to get 15% off your order. That's buyraycon.com/honeydew for 15% off Raycon wireless earbuds. If you've been eyeing a pair, I'm telling you now's the time to get an amazing deal. I'm going to say it one more time. Buy Raycon. That's RAYCON.com/honeydew. Our next sponsor is Vincero Watches, back with a fifth annual anniversary sale running August 11th to the 18th. I love my Vincero watch. I'm telling you, these are great watches. It's been a crazy 5 years for them, and simply saying thank you didn't feel good enough. So they wanted to do better and go bigger to show their appreciation for their customer support. So they're celebrating with one hell of a blowout sale. It's the biggest sale of the year. Everything on that site is on sale. There's no exclusions. Even the all-new collection they just dropped is available on sale. Products do sell out, so do not wait to buy. When it comes to watches, this is the best bang for your buck you will ever have the chance to get. You can't pass up a deal this good. It only happens once a year, and they have hit that five-year milestone. So it's a thank you to their customers and a celebration of how far they have come. At Vincero, they create exceptionally crafted timepieces at a fair price. Their products are bold, they're uncompromising, quite literally the best value in their industry. And by selling directly to the customer, they're able to provide the same look and feel of luxury watches 10 times the price of theirs, all right? I love this watch. This is something you can wear with a hoodie. You can dress it up. You can dress it down. Go check out their site. I'm telling you, there's so many watches. You'll love everything on there. It's going to be tough just to buy one. Head over to VinceroWatches.com/honeydewsale to take advantage of the biggest sale of the year. Again, that's VinceroWatches.com/honeydewsale. Go get something at the biggest sale of the year. And now back to the show.
And I'm going to this party every Friday night.
Same rave always?
So, well, all right. So DC had this party every Friday night called Buzz. It was the biggest rave in the country weekly. In the warehouse, right where the Nationals Park is now, it used to be in a club called the Capitol Ballroom, which you've probably been there. I think you had told me you'd been to the Capitol Ballroom. And then it became Nation. So this is like 98. That was like, you know, it was still Capitol Ballroom. The security hadn't beefed up. And it was just this huge, there's like probably 5,000-6,000 people every Friday night partying. And I start, you know, doing ecstasy and meeting girls and just, you know, having the best time of my life. And then I remember somebody was like, hey, you should try this stuff. It's called K. And I was like, and he was like, you want to buy a dub of it? And I'm like, oh, a dub, it must be like weed. And so he gives it to me and it's a fucking baggie. And so he's like, yeah, just snort it. And
this
so
is ketamine.
It's ketamine, yeah.
Cat tranquilizer, special
cat
K.
Tranquilizer, yeah. Ketacet.
This is what all the kids in where I grew up, the neighborhood, they break into the vet place and steal the ketamine. Yeah.
So, well, I found that and it was just the greatest feeling in the world, which is so funny because it makes you feel like you're stuck to whatever you're sitting on. But yet I would go into these.
You're in a happy place.
It's a disassociative. So like, it was weird, man. I had some really out of body experiences while I was on it at the rave because the music is so repetitive and you'd be walking from room to room and it's such a tight squeeze that people would just, they all fucked up on drugs. They would just be like zombies walking and I'm high and the music and the lights and all of that would like take me out of my body where. I guess it was like I had moments where I was like, I don't exist. Like, you know, I'm like, I thought I was dead while at these raves. But I did like it because it just made me feel good. And so I started selling it.
Selling ketamine?
Selling ketamine.
So how do you get it?
So.
Who's your supplier?
One of the guys that worked in the kitchen at Macaroni at Mozzarella's. Was off. I told you it was degenerates,
dude.
I
want to trace it back.
It was degenerates. So
and where
I forget what his
getting?
Name was. So there was a guy that worked in the kitchen, right? And he was like the all-star, all-met wide receiver for Damascus, right?
Yeah,
and
I played Damascus.
And then he got high on ketamine one night because he used to shoot it. He used to shoot it into his muscle, damn. Yeah. And I only snorted it. But he, one God. Night... I only smoked it all.
Thank goodness
gracious me. So I had he had gotten the ketamine and gotten high on it, and then he went to go pick up a friend and I think wrecked his car, and I think I don't know if that friend died, but I think something bad happened, so he had to go to jail. So he was on work release. But all those guys that are at those work release,
he's on work release,
he's on work release working in the kitchen. And all those guys that are on work release, they all still did drugs. They all still sold drugs. And so he would get it from one of the other guys that was on work release. And I think it was like $50 a vial.
And what is it, a liquid?
Yeah, it's a liquid. So it comes in like almost like if you were shooting like, you know, a Decadron or like an antibiotic.
I
mean? Just the regular thing that they go in and pull it out.
It's a liquid. But it's a liquid. How do you, he shoots it in, but how do you snort it?
So. I'd get it from him, and then you take the bottle and you rip the top off, right? You get two plates. You pour the juice on the plate. You put a plate on top of it. You put it in the microwave for 2 minutes and 30 seconds. You pull it out, lift up the thing. It's all crystallized, and you just shave it off and then bag it.
That's it.
That's it, dude. Some people, it actually is stronger if you the longer it takes for it to crystallize, the more powerful the ketamine will be. So some people would take plates, put it in with the plates, and then put a hair dryer on it and just sit there for like 3 hours.
Damn.
Yeah. And it was great.
It'll crystallize like that?
Yeah, it made the K good. So, I mean, you know.
Put it in the microwave for 22 minutes.
You got to wait if you want the good K.
It'll start popping up like Jif Pop. You'll see. You'll know when it's ready. You'll know.
So
you start making your own?
Yeah,
you get the liquid and you start making the powder
because,
yourself.
Yeah, because I wanted
to. In my mom's microwave.
Is
there any chance people can get high off the residual shit that's in that guy?
I don't think so. No.
I feel like they
could. It would help my parents out if they would have. You know what I mean?
Your dad's like, it's the best goddamn microwave pizza I ever had, baby. Tonight.
Mama Celeste, Mama Sebeste. This is incredible. So, I never got caught with it, but, you know, at that time, my parents, they couldn't.
All right, so wait, let's talk about it. How much are you selling? Like vials, a little vial?
No, so I would get one bottle for like 40, 50 bucks, mm-hmm. and then I would probably get like.
You turn that liquid into how many, and what do you sell, baggies?
Like 10 dime bags? 10 little dime bags, and what I would do is sell a bag for $20, and I would just sell two or three bags to make my money back, and then I would just do the rest. So
not a drug dealer so much as a drug user.
Yeah, I was literally
funding your habit
100% to fund my habit. And so from that, now I'm selling K at Rave.
And how often are you doing ketamine a week?
Probably three nights.
God,
three nights a week. Cause there was Wednesday night. There was the Edge. The Edge was just another club, like right up down the street from Nations. And then Thursday night was Trax, which was a gay club, but they had like a straight party on Thursday nights. And that was one of the best, you know, places to party in L.A. And then Friday night, not in L.A., in D.C. And then Friday night was always Buzz. And then Saturday would be like a house party.
So when I took you back to Baltimore last year and we went in that warehouse for the pregame for the Ravens for the Jimmy's party.
Yeah.
What was that rave?
That was a Paradox. That was Fever. That was you would come up for that. I think it was like the second Tuesday of every month was Paradox. And so I drive up to Baltimore to party, and we'd go out of town to go to raves. I mean,
you'd be selling at all these places?
Well, no, I'd sell when I did the Nations, when I'd go to like to go to Buzz, but I was like starting to venture more into doing coke, and it was just for the party. Like we would go up to New Jersey, and you know I'd go there, maybe take an ecstasy pill, do a bump of K, and then some
Jesus
of the
Jesus Christ, all that in one night.
Oh my God, that is fucking nothing. Do you know how many drugs I've mixed in my life?
I didn't know how many you mixed per night.
I remember one time I was in a club and I was high on K, and I meet some guy and he's like sitting on the floor. And so I was like, all right, well, this is a perfect place for me to sit. And I sat down next to him, and he was just like, hey man, if you give me a bump of your K, I'll give you an ecstasy pill. And I was like, done. And so we traded it. I took the pill. And we're hanging out, and then the next thing I know, I wake up and I'm in the car, and like people are like smacking my face, and they're like, they got like a chocolate bar
trying to shove it.
So like orange juice, like it's Steel Magnolias, yeah. Like, get him up, keep his head up, he doesn't bite his tongue. But that was the thing, Rye, was that I never learned how to do drugs or drink properly. So that just added to the mess that I was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're going to raves. I remember one rave we went to in New Jersey. Two of the guys I went with were high on PCP. Like that was all they wanted to do was smoke PCP. And
how would they smoke it?
Well, I don't know. There was like a whole section of people that were just smoking PCP. Yeah, that was it was in a big hockey arena. So it was like section 101, like in good seats.
Yeah. Right.
And they're down there. They're smoking PCP. And then me and Todd, the guy I worked with at Mozzarella's was like, yeah, we got to get out of here, man. We've been here. It's 5 a.m. The rave's shutting down. Go find Jesse and Aaron. And so I go and find them, and they're just like spun out, like real creepy looking. And then we get in the car and we get on the New Jersey Turnpike, and fucking Todd does something like stupid, like change lanes quickly, and we get pulled over. So like the cop walks up. First of all, Todd is like, he's got bleach blonde hair, goddamn like ski mask on, like goggles. I've got like stickers all over my face. My pupils are probably this big. And then you have Jesse and Aaron in the back just not moving. And the cop's like, where y'all coming from? We're like, oh, we were just at the hockey arena. We were at the party. He's like, you guys haven't been doing anything? And we're like, nah, man. And suddenly he's like, all right, well, let me get your ID. And Jesse and Aaron are sitting in the back. And you just hear Jesse suddenly go, It's like, what was that noise? Like, oh man, it's, I don't know. I don't think it feels good. We got let go. You know, it's so funny, man. I should have gone to jail far, so many times, but I always got let go in those situations. And I remember leaving a rave once with two girls, and I was high on ketamine, and I was sitting in the back, and this girl sideswiped a car around DuPont Circle and then just kept going. Well, that car was a fucking police officer.
Oh.
And so we get pulled over, and then they
chased
pulled
you?
They didn't chase us. He just drove like, whoop, whoop, and just
He
didn't have to do it.
No, he just turned the lights
off. Turned the lights off.
Hey, I'm a cop. You just hit my car.
All right, chill out.
Oh, God, man, let's pull over.
So he pulled us over, and there were the two girls in there, and the girls are like really getting scared, and they're like, "Well, we had a drink or two, and blah blah blah," and apologetic, and then he sees me in the back, and he pulls me out, and he starts talking to me. Now I'm in a massive K-hole. So you could.
What's that like?
It's just like you want to say words, but you can't. Like, you just be like,
but it makes sense to you, or it doesn't.
My name's Josh. Like, you would take, like, my name. You just can't move.
All right, I see what's going on here. I'm going to let these guys go. They got a special needs kid in the back here. We're going to go ahead and county's going to pay for this car. All right.
We got special needs. So,
county's gonna take this hit on the chin right here. We got a special needs kid in the back here. Josh, his name is Josh.
Can I get one of the special needs vans to pick up this guy? I'm gonna be arresting these two girls, but we gotta make sure he gets home. No, they didn't. They didn't arrest them.
They sideswiped a cop car and they got off.
Yes, and basically,
was it a cop? Like, was it a plane wrap or is it?
No, it was. Oh no, it wasn't in a cop car like that. It was in like the normal.
It was a cop.
It was a blind car. You know what I mean? If you want to call it that. And he pulls us over, and then he pulls me out, and he's like, "How are you doing? Do you want anything?" And I'm like, "No." And he goes, "Can you drive?" He's like, "Do you mind driving these girls home? I want to let them go." And I was like, "Okay." And then he puts,
"You know what? Let me get back. I'm gonna let the special needs kid drive these ladies overnight, man. Don't worry about this." This fucking cop,
this dumbass. So he puts me in the driver's seat. The girls get in the back. I literally drive like a half a block. He drives by us, and then we did the switch. I remember one time I told this story on the Crab Feast when one night we went to a rave with these guys I never hung out with, and they had been drinking and in the car, and they had coke and a gun, had all this crazy shit. And we got pulled over because he made an illegal left turn to get onto like 395, and we got pulled over, and I got blamed for everything because I was sitting by the beers. And so the cop put me in handcuffs, and, you know, I started crying.
As you do.
As I do. I cry a lot. So I started crying, angry tears, and not like sad tears, but angry, I was like, "You motherfuckers." I was like, "It's not mine. It's not mine. Say it." And the cop's like, "All right, this mother, like, let him go." And so they made us dump everything out. And, dude, even one time in Baltimore, me and my friend Matt were leaving. We were driving down Broadway, and we're at a stoplight, and we're high as fuck on coke, and we've been drinking. We just left JD's, and a cop pulls us over because it's such a weird intersection, that Broadway, Fleet Street. There's like a light here and then a light. It's so quick. We get pulled over, and the cop pulls us over. She's like, "Have you been drinking?" He goes, "I'm not going to lie to you. I have been." She's like, "How close do you live?" He's like, "Literally 7 blocks there." And she goes, "Get home."
Holy shit.
So I've gotten off a lot from different, like, you know, times that probably should have ruined my life at the time.
But you've talked to me, and I've even been with you at a time too, where you told me the process of how you find, like I say, how do you get these pills? Cause you also got into painkillers and stuff. When I met you, you were, what'd you tell me? 25 Vicodin a day for real?
So Vicodin started shortly after the raves because
ketamine led to
ketamine.
Vicodin.
So ketamine led to coke, and then coke and alcohol. And then what I started noticing was that I couldn't drink, because if I drank, like, I made a fool out of myself. But, like, I remember, like, at a huge house party, kicking over a big fire barrel that they were, like, you know, roasting marshmallows on, because I was just drunk, acting like an idiot. I would always get in trouble when I drank. So when I found opiates, because like my buddy just kept, he'd always get like, you know, a couple hundred and we'd just take one and you just felt incredible. Like all the shit my dad had said to me was just gone. And at that point I was a confident, like just, I was like the cool guy. Every time I did opiates, somebody told me this about how to explain the feeling on Oxycontin. It's like you walk into a room and you know that you feel better than every single person in there. Like you're floating or like getting into a bath and just taking that water with you. And if anybody have seen my Instagram stories, you know I love baths. So it's fucking, it's just because it's like, I think it's because I feel like I'm in my mom's womb and I'm just this still this scared little child throughout life. I handle it better now. But for a long time, I was just afraid of everything. And so I find opiates. Well, I'm still living at home and, you know, I would take a few from my mom here and there, but then I started, then Oxycontin.
So that's where you first got on your parents. See, I firmly believe that opiates are that gateway drug. Everybody's getting this shit in their parents' medicine cabinet and then it's leading to heroin. And
no, it is.
Fucking thing
no,
else.
It is. Well, so what happened was there was like where my dad really finally erupted on me was this is. I'm calming down on going to raves, but I'm like still doing coke. I'm still drinking. And me and my friend Joel go to this party in Towson, right? And I had a car that me and my mom shared. It was a brand new Honda Civic. And
Original rims.
It was a great 1999 car. It was great. My parents leased two cars because I wrecked another car on my way home from a rave. So, yeah, I know I'm a mess. So we go to this party. And I'm getting drunk. Joel's getting drunk, but Joel's not drinking as much as I am. And then it's time to end the party. And they're just like, you can sleep here. And I'm like, well, I have to get home because my mom needs the car tomorrow morning. And so Joel's like, I'll drive. I'm like, perfect. And then we get in the car and I'm like, dude, I can drive, man. I don't want you driving my car. And he's like, all right. And so we switch seats and I get behind the driver's seat. And as we're driving, we're taking 70 and then we get off in Damascus, which is these back roads. And I'm just going like 100 miles an hour down like a two-lane road. And you know how curvy it is in those Maryland back roads.
Yeah.
And we're just listening to Metallica. And I'm just like, you know, I remember like looking at Joel and like hearing Master of Puppets and being like, we're balling. And then next thing I know, the road curves and I overcompensate for it. And I just hit on the side of like a huge light pole.
Sideswipe it?
T-boned it. If that's it. Like, yeah. We should have died.
Oh, holy shit.
We should have died. It was a bad accident, but we were both fine. We were beaten and bruised. And the funniest thing was, as we're trying to get out of the car, the radio wouldn't go off. So it's just like, Master! Master! And I'm like, are you okay? Master of Puppets, come pull it. Come on, let's get out of here. Ha! Master! 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 I mean, it fucked us up. And that was the night, and the cops show up, they arrest me, and that was the night my dad was just like, he's like,
was that your first arrest?
My first arrest that my parents knew. Oh. You know, I had gotten arrested.
How'd you hide that? How'd you hide an arrest?
Oh, I got arrested at senior week in Myrtle Beach, public intoxication. So it was nothing. You pay the $50, you never have to come back. But this time, though, it was like the cops took me to the station in Germantown and then drove me to my parents' house, or my parents had to come and get me. And I remember my dad like walking downstairs, and this is like a brand new car, maybe like 8-9 months old. We've had it, and my dad just being like, he didn't even yell at me. My dad just like gave me that look that of just like you're a piece of shit. Like he just looked at me and he went right back upstairs. And so knowing that I couldn't drink, you know, then I started dabbling in the opiates. And I had friends that would do it. And then when I moved to Baltimore, that was when I was in this big rave collective called Syndrome.
It was a rave collective.
It was me, Mike Barbarisi, PJ, Eric, Brian, and Kyrell. They were like drum and bass DJs. And we threw this biweekly party at 1614 Eastern Avenue in Baltimore, this little nightclub. And I just moved to Baltimore because after the first DUI accident, I had to get my life together. And I started working at school to try to get trust back from my parents. And then I moved to Baltimore. And that was where PJ was this dealer of like Oxycontin. He had every pill you could think of. He'd be like, you want to fall asleep? You need a Valium. He's like, you got indigestion? You want Lipitor? Like, what do you need?
Lipitor.
He had everything. And that was when I started dabbling in Oxycontin. And back then you could actually snort it still. So you'd like,
what do you mean still? You can't.
Well,
now?
So it used to be like a powdered form. So it was a pill that you could crush.
Right.
Now, because so many people overdosed and were basically just using the pill to snort or to smoke, they turned it into like a, not like a gel, but like a hard gel. So you can bite it, but it's like, it won't give you the same like instantaneous effect as it used to where you could, when you snorted it.
Now it's time release or whatever.
Yeah. But that was when I started dabbling in that. And I remember like one of my problems was like, I always wanted to like to be in love, and there were so many different girls that we'd go out on like one or two dates. And then I just like turn into of mice and men and just like call them like 40 times in a row because I just wanted to hang out with them. And so there wasn't cell phones back then. So, and I would just scare these girls off. And I remember there was some girl in Baltimore that I met and we hung out for a week. And then I dropped her off after she spent the night at my house one night at the gym she worked at. And then she just like ghosted me. And I was just, you know, miserable. And that was when I was dabbling in opiates. And then I started buying more and drinking. And then I had to drop out of school and move back to my parents' house because I just run up my credit cards and I was in debt. And I worked for like a restaurant, you know, for a while. And I just kept, you know, taking more and more painkillers because that just made me feel great. And then I get back to school, I keep partying, but opiates had chilled out for a while until I got my third DUI. Because I still got two other DUIs after that. Like I got one. I got one when I was 19. That was the first one. Or 20. I got the second one at 22.
You got a DUI before you were even 21.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big deal.
I didn't get in a lot of trouble for my DUIs. Like, to be honest with you, first one got dropped because the cop felt bad for me because I was crying on the from the accident site to the jail. I was just like, my parents are going to kill me. And he's like, you're going to be all right, man. And I was just like,
he's pep talking you.
He's like, don't worry about it, man. You're going to be fine. And I'm just like, my dad's going to, he already hates me.
So he let you go?
He didn't let me go. He never, like, so I got a lawyer and then we went to court and he never showed up. And so they dropped the charges. So on the second DUI, I was leaving a party in Baltimore and we get to, I probably had like three or four beers and I go to leave and I'm driving down like Lock Raven Boulevard and I guess one of my taillights was out, so I got pulled over, and I blew a .08, but that was like right at the limit. So, you know, they made me park my car, and then they arrested me, and then I went to jail. Not jail. I went to a, like...
holding cell.
I went to the Baltimore County Detention Center because I admitted that I had a DUI before, not knowing that that one never showed up because it was dropped.
Oh.
And I was in there for only a day. And then that started like the downfall. Then with that and the girl and everything, I was just using way too much. And
what
I had
was
to
your,
move
like,
back
daily
home.
Routine?
Back then,
it was drugs. I mean,
what do you mean?
At that time.
At that time, it was
every day. Are you doing coke?
It was way. Well, yeah, I wasn't doing coke. No, I was just doing a lot of drinking. And so maybe like once or twice a week I'd do opiates, but I would have a bong hit like the second I waked up. And then every night I would drink. Like I would drink every night because that's all you do in Baltimore. Yeah. You know that. But then it was like I moved back home, got my life back together, worked for a chicken wing restaurant called Cluck You.
Cluck You Chicken, bro. College Park?
I worked at the one in Germantown. That's right. And they made us. They made us when we answered the phone because this was like a separate entity. They all have different owners. We had to answer the phone. I'm the general manager, and we had to go, "Pagad, Cluck You Chicken." I swear to God, dude.
I don't remember you ever telling me that.
I swear to God, I've told you that. You'd be like, "Pagad, Cluck You."
We got another call coming in. Hang on a second.
But it was so funny because I worked there to get out of debt because I'd run up my credit card debt so high. And
are things getting better, worse? No change with your dad at this point?
Here's what I did. No, me and my dad, like, I would lose his trust and then I'd start gaining it back. And then I would do something huge. Like, I got accepted to college and he'd be like, yes, Josh is on the right track. And then I get to college and I start drinking and partying. I get a DUI and then I move back home. You know, and then it was like, I'm going to be in a band for a while and just party. And then I would do that. My dad looks at me like I'm a piece of shit. And then something happens and I just switch and I start, you know, cleaning my act up. I'm not drinking as much. I start working hard at JC. And the next thing I know, I go back to college. And so I worked at Cluck U Chicken, paid off my debt, got reaccepted into Towson. And then I started going back to Towson. And then it was just drinking and doing coke. But I was like, I didn't get any DUIs. I didn't do anything wrong. I was actually finishing school and just working my butt off. And then I graduate college and it is like, I get this job at Channel One News, which is like, it just went under,
didn't it? Finally,
I don't know, but it was, I meet people that had Channel One. Channel One was,
yeah, when you mentioned it on the Crab Feast, a bunch of people hit us
bananas.
Up and said, who've been, like, Anderson Cooper, I think.
Anderson Cooper, Alexander Marquardt, I had worked with him, he's like a CNN dude. But it was this great job, but I got hired, and for the first, like, 2 months that I lived there, I was just drinking and doing coke a lot, because now I have money, and what happens is on one night I get off work and I go to this bar that was across the street because there was this beautiful blonde girl that worked there and she would just feed me Johnny Walker and barely charge me. Maybe I have an app like a bruschetta.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I get hammered and then I would just drive back from Connecticut Avenue back home. One night I just was drinking and the next thing I know I'm on 270 like drunk as fuck, you know, trying to get to my parents' house where I was staying. And I get off the highway and I'm driving down Middlebrook or 118 and a cop gets behind me. And so I pull over into this gas station to try to lose the cop. And then I get back in the car and I start driving into my parents' neighborhood and that cop just shows up right behind me with his lights on.
Yeah.
Now it's December, so I'm just like, fuck this, man. I'm just gonna drive to my parents' house and get out of the car and walk inside. And just act like, you know, this never happened. And I remember I park. I start getting out of that car. I walk up to the front door. And the next thing I know, that cop just runs up behind me and starts choking me. Throws me down. It's a little woman. She's this little woman. She fucking.
Goddamn, you an elf. Is that an elf on my back?
But she throws me down. And then she's like, why were you running from me? Why were you running? I was like, where'd you come from? And she's like, how did you not see me? I had the lights on for the last like 5 minutes. And I was like, oh, I just thought you were the Christmas lights.
She was like,
go fuck yourself. So I say to her, I'm like, just arrest me. I was like, I'm drunk. Take me to jail. I don't want to
say this.
Yeah, because it's in front of my parents' house, man. Like,
have they come out yet?
No. And I didn't want them to.
Are the lights on the car?
Lights on everything, dude. The Johnsons woke up. They were outside like, typical Josh, that piece of shit. That motherfucker, look at him over there. Ran over the bushes again. So from that moment, like, I realized that it was like I had to really, like, clean myself up. And alcohol was not the way to do it.
Wait, so did your parents come out and find you?
No, they didn't find out that I got the DUI until it was already case closed when I told them, like, you know, 7-8 months later.
So they didn't even see the whole incident out front or anything?
They didn't see any of
that. The lady arrested you and
took you? She arrested me and took me to jail. And then I think they released me just on my own recognizance. They write you up and then they just let you go. But they took my car.
Like a 12-hour hold or some shit like that.
Not a 12-hour hold, but they took my car. They tow it, so it's not like I can drive anyway. So they're just like, find your way home. And
so a cop and a tow truck showed up at that house. Your parents never fucking came out and saw a thing.
They're deep sleepers, man. They
clearly
sleep through that shit. But from that, I stopped drinking and really haven't drank regularly since that. But what happened was a month later, I went to the gym and I was doing some exercise and I turned my head a certain way as I'm pulling and I pop something in my neck. And so I go to like an urgent care and they're like, well, you know, can you get a ride? Can somebody come pick you up? I was like, yeah, I can get my mom to pick me up. They're like, cause we want to give you like a painkiller. And they gave me Dilaudid and gave me a shot of Dilaudid and they gave me a prescription for Vicodin. And then that was it. Like I felt so incredible. I remember going home and I'm joking with my family. And then I have some painkillers throughout the week. So I'm taking that. And then that's what started me to go doctor shopping.
Yeah, talk about doctor shopping, because I found this fascinating when you were doing it.
So, all right, so doctor shopping, I don't know if you can do it as much anymore, but doctor shopping is, you know, especially if you have insurance, it can work. But if you pay out of pocket, it works a lot easier. So you go to a doctor, and you're just like, I have a back pain, and it's killing me. And my story was always, I hurt my back, and I have to work. And I move around a lot. So I need something just to get me through. I'm like, I got 2 weeks and then I'm off. It's always, I got 2 weeks of work and then I can rest and take care of myself. And most doctors, they look at me and, you know, I wouldn't look like shit. So they were just like, okay. And they give me a prescription for like 50 Vicodin ES or Norcos or whatever.
And you would just show up at their office?
If I go to a lot of urgent cares or emergency rooms, some emergency rooms, when I started doing it out here in Los Angeles, some emergency rooms, like, I remember I went like 5 times in 3 months.
You're connected now. Yeah. All that shit.
And they would just be like, they made me sign something saying I couldn't come back. They were like, we'll help you this time, but please don't come back here.
Really?
Yeah. Cause they know what I'm doing at a certain point. But in LA, I started to, like, because I was like, God, I've done all the American English-speaking doctors. Let me go to some of these in Koreatown. And so I'd have to go to Koreatown, where literally I'm the only white person in the room. It would be like, Dr. Long Dong Schlong, like, and literally I'd have to explain to him. He barely speaks English, and I'm just like, back! Ooh! Vicodin? Vicodin! I swear to God, dude. And they would write me a prescription.
Just to get you the fuck out of there.
Just to get me the fuck out of there, dude. Because they can't say no. If I'm just like, I'm in pain and they do all the tests and I'm also a paying customer, they assume if I'm going to pay like $150 for the appointment, little did they know I was giving them a bad check.
You were writing bad checks?
Yeah.
So hold on, dude. So you're writing bad checks on top of getting illegal fucking drugs? And then doesn't that come back to bite you in the ass, the bad checks?
I closed that account.
Closed it.
It was
just open a new account.
It was an
time.
Account that was in Maryland.
I got 14 toasters, man.
It was an account that was closed. You want a hot air cooker? What you want? I got you everything.
I had a cooler one time. I got a cooler.
What I would do is I'd go to the doctor. The doctor's offices would take checks. And so you're writing, you know, an appointment with some of them were like $500. I'm going to like a specialist out here in California. So I would give them, I just give them a $500 check and then I'd get the prescription for opiates and I'd go fill it. I mean, it was.
Is it a one-off? Or you get a refill on those. You have to get
some. You get a refill.
Back
but
then, these days, it's usually have to call to refill. Now, I believe.
Well, yeah, you'd call it in from the prescription bottle, but it would be on there, and you're just going to Rite Aids. And so, after a while, I knew that the doctor shopping just wasn't working as easy as I wanted it to. So then I started calling in fake prescriptions at pharmacies here in Los Angeles.
And what do you would just call Rite Aid?
So, yeah, so you take the prescription, and it's got the DEA number and then all the doctor's information. So I call a Rite Aid.
And say you're who
I'd be like,
you?
I'm Dr.
You would say you're the
I'd
doctor.
I'd say I'm Dr. Bitswani. Yes, I'm calling in prescription for Tony Baker. Like, I'd use all comics that I knew.
Yeah, right.
I'd be like, I'm calling in prescription for Jay Larson for Vicodin ES. Take one pill every 4 to 6 hours is needed for pain. 3 refills.
But then you go, and don't you have to show up with that ID?
No.
What do you mean?
So the first one, I was really scared.
Jay Larson, you don't have to show up with Jay Larson.
No, not at that time. I don't know what they do now, but at that time, you can't even call in a prescription for opiates now. You have to actually have like the prescription pad. But basically, I remember the first one, I was just risking it, and I called a Walgreens, and I've never been more scared walking up to that counter. And I walk up to him And I'm just like, yeah, I'm here to pick up the prescription. I gave my real name the first time and they filled it. And I was like, holy shit. They didn't ask for ID or nothing. I was like, this shit works. So then I just started calling this Rite Aid and they would fill it every time. And I just do a different name. And I literally use comedians that I knew, you know, and yeah, here to pick up for Kurt Bronelicher.
They can't even say his name.
But I never really got in trouble for it. And so I would just call in more and more because, dude, you're getting a prescription for fucking like $30. You're getting a prescription for $30. And if I got that same amount on the street, it would cost, you know, 100 painkillers I used to buy from this dealer in downtown L.A. for $300. So that's $3 a pill. I'm getting them for like 50 cents a pill. And I never got caught.
Did you sell those sometimes?
That's the thing is I never sold them.
No.
I just took them because, you know, when I moved.
What is the street value of a pill? If you're getting it for 50 cents, what, a 10, 5?
A 10, a 10 milligram.
No,
a 10,
I mean price. How many?
I know, but I'm saying a 10 milligram pill of Vicodin, so hydrocodone, now, or the last time I bought it, which was well over 3 years ago, would be about $7 a pill. Sometimes you can find somebody to give it to you for $5. The Vicodin ES, which were 7.5s, and had a lot of Tylenol in them, I found a dealer in downtown LA that would sell it for $3 a pill, but only because I was buying 100. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
he knocked off some money for it. And that was just too expensive. So when you're in the throes of addiction, like you'll just do anything. That's all you care about is not getting sick. You know, and plus during that time, you know, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I didn't have a lot of friends. I hadn't started stand up yet. I was working in television and I was just lonely, and Vicodin made me feel whole, you know? So I just didn't care about the ramifications, didn't care about my credit, didn't care about anything. I just wanted to get high.
Well, when you started to see the increase amount, like when you, like I said, you met me, you were 20 to 25 a day, like, I mean, if you're buying 100 pills, that's only 4 days worth. Or a week's worth.
Yeah, I'd say it would be about a week.
You could rip through 100 pills in a week.
I could, easy.
And it's not
easy.
It's not
three or four days.
Constipating you or ripping your stomach apart or you're shitting. I know that.
Oh, yeah,
dude. Shit for days.
Oh, yeah. I remember one time, this was after when I started going from Vicodin to the harder drugs. Like, I remember one time I didn't shit for like 5 days.
5 days?
So I had to take a stool softener. And that worked, you know, it didn't really affect me, dude. When I was taking painkillers, man, everything was great. Like my whole life could be falling apart, but I felt incredible. And I then started stand up. And when you're talking about the time where I took 25, when I met you was because I got my first show at the Hollywood Improv. I'm hanging out with all the comics and I just started doing opiates again. And I had my first real actual show at the Improv. And I remember I started the morning with like 5, then I take 5 more a few hours later. And by the time I got on stage, I was at probably 25, 30. Dude, on my birthday one night, I fucking took 55.
55
throughout the whole day. Through the whole day.
In a 12-hour day.
Yeah, dude. When we were doing the Unknown Theater, like I remember, and I was giving them out to fucking one of the guys in the band. And it was just... you build up a tolerance.
I hear you build up a tolerance, but like I've said before, if I did 55 Advil, M&Ms, my fucking body would throw them up. But you also get like with weed, I can only get to a point where I don't get any higher. After that, I'm just smoking and it's doing nothing but either maintaining or, you know, I'm wasting it. 55, aren't you just fucking through the roof? Like, how can you talk?
It made
walk,
me. See,
you were doing stand up.
It was
that?
Giving me that. See, that's what happened was when I did that stand up set, I fucking walked out there and I felt no pain. I was the most confident comedian. Like, I was Chris Rock when I walked out there. And everybody on that show ate shit but me. I fucking
you
ripped.
Were in Vicodin.
Yes, I did. 25 of them.
God. Damn.
But I killed, dude. And so I get off stage and everybody's dapping me and like, dude, you're fucking funny, man. Like, I've seen you go up. I didn't really think you were that funny, but you can do this shit. And so in my head, I was only funny if I was high. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So then it just got even worse. Like, it would just every show I would have to, you know, get high and do painkillers. But I couldn't afford, because I'm a broke comic now. I'm not working in television. So I, what's easier, go downtown, spend $300 on 100 pills, or call it in, call in a prescription for 50, and that's 14 bucks.
Right.
You know, so eventually, I did it at a pharmacy on Ventura. There is a
is this one of my favorites?
Yeah, story? This is.
Yeah, I want you to repeat this.
So one time I go into this pharmacy.
I tell everybody
at the corner of Crescent Heights and not Crescent Heights. It was Laurel Canyon and Ventura, and I go in there and I call a prescription for 30 Vicodin ES, right? And I'm waiting in line. Also at the time, like I just any name I could get, just I just was so strung
out.
You're
also, yeah, I was gonna say, out of your mind.
I'm so strung out. And so I go in line, and there's this girl, and she's in line, and we start talking to one another, and I'm flirting with her, she's flirting back, and then eventually they call and they're like, all right, you're next. And so I turn it on, I go, hold on, I'll be right back. And then I just go, ah, fuck my back. And then I start walking up
gingerly walking
up. You gotta play it up. I'd have to be like, you need my wallet?
Y'all got any crutches?
Oh. I come in on a Rascal scooter, like, no, but I'm like, let me get my wallet. Oh shit, hurts when I turn. And then I pull my wallet out and I'm like, yeah, I'm here to pick up the prescription. And the guys give him the name and he looks at me. And he just goes, all right. He goes, wait right here. And he starts to go in the back, but he will not take his eyes off of me.
Oh, he's
like, this dude is eyeballing me. Dude, there's probably 15 people in line. Keep this in mind. And then the guy turns around and walks up in front of everybody. He goes, attention, everyone in this pharmacy. That man right there called in a fake prescription for Vicodin. If I ever see you in here again, Mr. Oral Hershiser. I will call the police. Now leave.
Oral Hershiser, yeah. You use in fucking Los Angeles. Actually, anywhere. That name, there is no other Oral Hershiser unless it's in that fucking town. That is unbelievable.
I mean, I already like used that. Vladimir Guerrero.
Ron Carew was taken. He called you.
If I see you in here again, Pistol Pete Medovich.
He fucking told everybody in that store, called you out. He humiliated
me, and then I walked by.
What did you do?
I go, all right, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, you got to throw it back at him. Like, man, you crazy. All right, I see y'all. Man, what you talking about? All right, you acting like that again? All right, I see how it is. You know I'm a gold glove winner.
You know my bullpen session's about 15. I got to get the fuck out of here. Oh, my God. Oral Hershiser. I can't even believe you did. That's how fucking out of your mind you were to use that name.
But that's what's funny is that didn't stop me. It's like
Scottie Pippen in Chicago. You know, it's crazy.
I know, but you just don't think, dude. You just do. And you know, then I started dating Brittany shortly after that. Mm-hmm. Like I started, you know, I got a job at the strip club as a DJ.
You seem to have managed to somehow keep drugs around you throughout your jobs.
Drugs. It would be, well, when I got that third DUI, that was it with me and alcohol. I drank when I first moved to Los Angeles, because I wanted to fit in, and that's what I thought everybody did.
Yeah, I've never
did.
Seen you have a drop of alcohol.
No, you might have. Yeah, you. I mean, I haven't drank regularly in 13 years, but I haven't drank actually in over 5 now. But I would have, like, what I would do is, I would stay sober throughout the whole year, right? But then my buddy Beinfest moved to Venice. And what I would do, he was a guy I used to do party and do coke with in Baltimore. And when he moved to Venice, I would just get so frustrated with the career. And I would just be like, yo, man, I'm coming over. And I'd see him. It'd be like midday, 4 p.m. I'd drop like $500, or I'd be like, let's get as much coke as we can. And I would just do drugs for like 2 days straight. Drink and do cocaine. And then I'd stop doing it. And then I'd go back to LA, go back to Hollywood, and I wouldn't do it again for a year. It was like Rumspringa. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it was my Rumspringa. Like, I wanted to do as many drugs as I could in those 2 days. And then that would appease me. You know, it's like giving the monster, like, you know, like a sacrifice. And But then I, when I found comedy, it was just opiates and weed. And then I start dating Brittany, and me and Brittany, she starts cleaning me up even more. And then finally, after having lost and won my dad's love, when I got with Brittany, he started to like become proud of me. You know, I got, okay. I got a bank account again. You know, I was paying, I wasn't paying, you know, like my debt back, but I was just working. He saw the work that I was doing. Like comedy saved my life. It gave me something to like really hold on to. Yeah.
Me too. For
yeah.
Sure.
I mean, it's like, that's been the one consistent, and it's like,
yeah,
like with drugs helped me with the confidence, helped me with all of that on stage. But once, you know, I, at that point when I got with Brittany, it was like, I was, you know, I would just smoke pot and I was just doing spots and we had a home and we had dogs and everything was great. My mom and dad were proud of me. And then, you know, shortly into the relationship, I started just taking painkillers again. And I think that was probably the demise, the beginning of what destroyed our relationship. The you know, the lies, you know, like she knew I took painkillers once in a while.
I know the lies.
Yeah. So it was just like, just to not, I just didn't, you know, so I could just do drugs and still have this life. And it was such a battle. Like I would go a month clean, party for 2 weeks. Cause I'm working at a strip club, man. It's like,
it's all around.
I hated that job, but at the time I didn't hate it as much, but I hated being in that relationship. Like that was, it was a hard relationship to be in. And it was just like, she would yell at me, you know, she had issues. So she would just, you know, shit on me and then she'd love me and then she'd shit on me and then she'd love me. And so I started partying a little bit. And then towards the end of the relationship, you know, it got bad and, you know, my dad got sick and he died. And
yeah, I remember when you went home for that.
Yeah. And what happened with my dad, which I can build off of now and I can look back at all the stuff that he did, because he wasn't a horrible father. Like he just never had a father. So he didn't know how to raise me, you know?
But also you were a fucking hellion.
Yeah,
like even if he did have a dad, I wouldn't know how to raise that either. You wouldn't know how to raise you. If you were a dad right now and you had exactly what you had, you wouldn't know how to fucking do that.
I'd love him. I wouldn't shit on him.
I hear you on
I wouldn't do that. You know, you had a mom that was like that,
yeah.
You know, and you've turned out great considering, you know, losing your dad so early and losing your mom and really losing your mom. She might as well have been dead for years.
Yeah.
You know, I luckily had my mom.
Yeah.
She was a consistent, but my dad, like, it's so funny, right? Like
did he ever say the words, I hate you? Did you ever hear that out of your father? Or do you usually get the, I'm disappointed, like that salt?
I don't think my dad
shit.
Ever said he hated me.
No.
I really don't. But I mean, he would just, anything that went wrong, it was my fault. Anything. He's like, we're missing money. Josh, you steal the money? And I'm like, no, I didn't steal it. Like, I mean, it was just, I would get blamed for everything. If something got cleaned up, if there was a mess, whatever it was, you know, even now, my mom, when we get together, like she'll bring up my dad and she'll be like, you know, well, he was always so hard on you and me. You remember when he said this to you? And I'm like, no, I don't remember that. Thank you for reminding me of this horrible thing my dad said, you know? and that's the thing is that I'm able to drop all of that because I'm looking at how it ended. You know, my dad.
How old was your dad when he died?
69. Him and my mom went up to Pennsylvania for.
Did they stay together the whole time?
Yeah. Oh, they hated each other.
But they stayed together though.
For us. And my mom, that's the thing is my mom will not drop that. Like she's like, I should have left your father, but I stayed together for you two. I'm like, no. You fucked up. You can't be mad.
That's right.
You don't blame me and Jody for you not, you know, say, you know, taking control of your life and being like, I mean, like, no, I don't. This, you're treating me like shit. We shouldn't be together. You're on your own. And she's very martyr like. So my dad and my mom go up to Pennsylvania for her reunion. And I guess my dad just was out at my dad's friend's house and just started having like chest pains. And how I found out was I was working at the strip club, Friday shift. It was probably like 3, 4 p.m. I used to get off at 6:30, and my mom calls me, and she's just like, you can hear it in her voice. She's like, Josh, you need to go home now. Brittany's packing you a bag. She's like, you have to go to the airport. I'm buying you a ticket. Dad is having heart surgery. You need to come home now. Bring a suit.
Oh my God.
So she's like, it's bad. And I start freaking out. And I remember running into like the street, like running out of the club into the street. You know, luckily we're out by the train tracks, because that's where they always put every strip club. Like,
yeah, right.
You know, but I remember getting in my car, and my manager was like, just go. I get in my car, and then I call my sister, who was a doctor, and I go, Jody, what's going on? And she's just like, this is bad. You know, she just leveled with me. She goes, Josh, this is really bad. He had an aneurysm, we think, and he's going into heart surgery now. I don't know what's going to happen. And I just was losing it. And I get home, and Brittany was there, and she, you know, for however the relationship ended with us fucking fighting and her leaving me for another guy or whatever it was, like, I'll love that girl forever because how strong she was when my dad,
you know, I love her.
Yeah, I know. She's great. I'm not shitting on her. It's like, we've gone back and forth with like love and hate before we became friends again. And now we're friends, but she was so great when my dad got sick that I'll love her unconditionally forever. And I'm so happy she's happy now. But, my dad actually didn't die. He lived. They saved him a 10% chance of survival. And so I had a month with my dad. And in that month, you know, me and my dad talked a lot on the phone. And he just basically was like, I'm proud of you. That's, you know, cool. I'm so happy that you followed your dreams, and I know you're going to be okay. And I look at my life as that moment now with my dad, not,
can I ask you?
Yeah, go ahead.
At that last month, did he know he was gonna die? Did they tell him you don't have much time? I mean,
no.
Did he know he was saying goodbye?
No. He didn't. That was what was funny, is that they saved him, and then he was in the hospital in Pennsylvania. Then they got him down to Maryland, and he was fine. And then he would just start having these weird heart palpitations, not pains, but palpitations. And you know, they had to keep checking on him to make sure he was all right. And they'd be like, yeah, this is giving us a little worry, so we're going to take you in for these tests. And then eventually, they were like, we have to put a stent in your neck because you have an artery that's clogged. And they put him under. It was at Johns Hopkins. But I think he knew then, because I remember right before that, my mom was like, he said he was nervous. You know, he's like, I've been through a lot, man. You know, in the last month, I've been poked, I've been prodded. Like, I'm tired. And they put him under, and he had a stroke, and he was gone.
While he was under?
Yeah.
Oh.
And he was gone. I remember I got the phone call. My mom's like, you need to come home. Like, stop, you know, because I just did not want to accept it. And I just was like, Brittany and Angelo and I were hanging, and I was just like, no, this is what I'm doing. He's going to be fine. He's going to be fine. And then finally my sister was like, dude, you have to come home. Like, dad's going to die. We have to say goodbye to him. And I went back. And I remember, like, this is just where I was at. Like, I was, you know, I hadn't been using painkillers, but I walked into that house and saw my dad's, you know, oxys on the counter. And I was like, fuck this. I'm not doing this sober, you know. And I just got high and then went to go say goodbye to my dad. And you walk in there and he's got the head shaved with a scar from here to here. And I held his hand. And, you know, I always remember how soft his hand was. It was like, it was just, and he was gone. He was a vegetable. And, they took him off the thing, and then that was it, you know. And I remember that the day of my dad's funeral, I had a cousin, my friend Greg came up because he loved my dad, and I hadn't been drinking really, but I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna drink some wine. And I got drunk at my dad's funeral, not like a scene, but just had some beer. Right. And then my cousin was there, and she was addicted to painkillers because there's like a lot of friends in her high school in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Because half the country is fucking addicted. Well,
but this is Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So it's like everywhere there. I remember her going through her yearbook and being like, dead, arrested, rehab, valedictorian, rehab. But she got me oxys. And I remember I went to the bathroom. She got me enough for the week. And I got to the bathroom, and I snorted a painkiller. And then that night, me and Greg had been drinking. And we get back to my aunt's house where they're sitting Shiva. And they literally have a rabbi come, and he does like a prayer every night the Mourner's Kaddish. And I remember I walked in and my dad had these two friends, Ralph and Malcolm, Ralph Prinsky and Malcolm Cohen. And Malcolm was just, I loved him so much when I was younger. But as I got older, I realized how much of a dick this guy was to my mom. He was just my dad's friend from high school. And I remember Malcolm, like, I don't know if he walked up to me, but he said to my mom, but I remember he said, he was like, he looked at me, he said, your dad always said he should have been harder on you. Yeah.
I've had someone say something like that to me too, and they were carrying my dad's body out of the house. I'm like, this is the time you want
exactly.
to fucking say that
exactly.
shit right now?
And that was it. That was literally it between me and him. I was just like, cool, that's, we're done. And from that, it was just, you know, I go back to LA and then I would still dabble with painkillers. But around a year after my dad died, I remember I started getting into the program, to like a 12-step yeah. program. And that was right at the time we went to Thai Palms.
Yeah.
And then me and Brittany break up. She leaves me for another guy and I go home. And then I Wait. Just, and then I like, I go home. My mom's got all these painkillers. I'm sad that that Brittany's broken up with me. Angelo just found out he had cancer. So I'm like all alone in LA. So of course I want to get high. And then we get back from the holidays and there was this glimmer of hope because Ange had beaten the cancer. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to be high now, but I'll get back to LA and I'll sober up. And the night I got back home, me and Ange get hit by a drunk driver.
Yeah.
Ange is gone. Angelo dies. I break my arm, fracture my skull. I'm taken to the hospital and they're like, here's all the painkillers.
That's when I learned what the Lauded was.
Well, because you were coming in to see me and I would just be like laid out and I'd start talking and then it would be like at 2 hours, I'd be like, yeah, it's 2 hours. I need another hit.
Yeah.
And then they would come in and shoot me up.
Yeah. I was a really difficult, sad time.
That was really
tough. But now, how long have you been clean and sober now?
I've been clean since May 17th, 2016.
That's great. You're over 3 years.
Over
Good
3 years.
You, dude.
Thank you, man. Well, there was, you know, it got to a point. Angelo dies, and for 7 months, it was hardcore opiate use, $300 a day. And then I got sober. Like, I remember I cleaned up. I was like, I'm done.
You spent $300 a day?
Yeah. Everybody donated money to me, and it was just like, I get insurance money, and it's just, dude, I just lost my best friend. They were giving me all these strong painkillers, and then suddenly it was like, oh, we're not going to give them to you anymore. So I was like, fuck this. I didn't want to be alive. Like, I literally wanted to take painkillers and overdose and die. Because I tried to go back to stand up to feel normal. And for 7 months, it was just hardcore opiate use. And I was like, I'm fed up with this. And then I went through the withdrawals, went through the detox. And my life got incredibly better. Because now I'm not drinking. I'm not doing coke. I'm not fucking, you know, taking painkillers. And then right around the time I got new faces, you know, I had these like passport issues and I was just like, it scared the shit out of me that I had worked for New Faces and I might not be able to go because the federal government's like, we're not going to give you your passport. And so I remember I started using again. And then it was just, that's all it ever was from that point. It was just, as I started getting success, I never felt like I deserved it because my dad said to me, and because of losing Ange, and I would just take painkillers and then I would, you know, get sober for a couple weeks. And then as the goddamn comedy jam got bigger, I get nervous and I take more painkillers. And then it was just like, well, I can only do the jam if I'm high. And it just was like, now I have money, but I'm still working at the strip club and I feel like a piece of shit because I'm working there, but I'm doing all this great stuff. And my body was just going through this like horrible cycle of not dealing with anything because I would just numb myself. And then finally, in May of 2016, I had had one final relapse, and I remember Sam Tripoli saw me at the Comedy Store, and I was pale white, and I looked like shit, and he goes, you relapsed again, didn't you? And I was like, yeah, man, I did. And he goes, when are you going to stop this? And I go, probably when I die. And he goes, or you're going to be the 50-year-old guy still hanging out at the Comedy Store that almost had a TV show, but then he ruined it because of drugs.
Yeah.
And at that exact moment, it was like done.
Good for Sam
Just
Triple.
Done.
Yeah.
And then I haven't taken him since.
That's great.
Yeah.
You sold a series to Comedy Central.
Sold a series on opiates, actually. So it did help for a lot of stuff. I mean.
But also, you now have a podcast at Spotify. So you're doing great.
Yeah.
You're doing really good. Yeah.
Everything's great, man.
Well,
I
love you. I'm glad you're fucking cleaned up because, boy, it was a ride, son. It was a ride. Thank you for coming on, dude.
Oh, it's my pleasure, buddy.
I love you.
I love you to death.
Why don't you one more time plug whatever you'd like to plug and promote?
You can find me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media. Go to the website, the500podcast.com or joshadammyers.com, and check out the 500 Podcast on all platforms.
All right, brother. I am Ryan Sickler on all social media, ryansickler.com. We'll talk to y'all next week.